The third thing this is analogized to is to a building. And David read the verses earlier, 1 Corinthians 3, verses 10 through 15, where our works are put through a fire. We're not put through the fire, our works are, to test their quality. And 1 Corinthians 3, 10 through 15, talks about how some people's works are like wood, hay, and stubble. What do wood, hay, and stubble have in common? They're combustible. They won't survive the fire. What are those things? Those are things that we wasted our life on as Christians. Things for self rather than for God. But then there are other works we do that are gold, silver, and costly stones. What do those have in common? They're non-combustible. The only thing a fire can do is purify them. It can't destroy them. So those things come out the other end, and whatever is left after the fire finishes its consumption is part of a reward that we receive above and beyond salvation. And this is how this judgment seat is going to work. You know, some of the complaints that I've heard since I've been here is people say, well, we just don't have the numbers we used to have, or we just don't have the numbers that we want to have. Can I ask you a question? When the Lord says, well done, thy good and faithful servant, does He say, well done, thy good and successful servant? He doesn't say that at all. The issue with God is faithfulness. Whether you're successful, whether I'm successful, that's in the providence of God. How much control do I have over that? Really not a lot. But I'll tell you what, something I can do. I can be faithful with what I have. Because God's given us all something. And so the issue of stewardship is, have you been, it's not success, it's not numerical growth, it's have you been faithful with what God has given you. You see that? That's what the stewardship brings out, and that's what this building brings out. So what I'm trying to get at is faithfulness in the body, in the life of the Christian matters. God keeps a record of it. And one of the best quotes I have on this whole thing is this quote by Samuel Hoyt. He says, "The judgment seat of Christ might be compared to a commencement ceremony. At graduation, there is some measure of disappointment and remorse that one did not do better and work harder. However, at such an event, the overwhelming emotion is joy, not remorse. The graduates do not leave the auditorium weeping because they did not earn better grades. Rather, they're thankful that they have been graduated and they are grateful for what they did achieve." Now watch this very carefully. To overdo the sorrow aspect of the judgment seat of Christ is to make heaven into hell. And there's a lot of people out there doing that by overemphasizing this doctrine. But then on the other end of the stick, to undervalue the sorrow aspect is to make faithfulness inconsequential. We're not trying to turn heaven into hell here by making it some sort of punitive operation. But at the same time, we're not ignoring the doctrine, because if we ignore the doctrine, then we're teaching that faithfulness as a Christian doesn't matter. It does matter. And so we're kind of in a balancing act with this doctrine. And you'll find pastors and theologians and churches putting no emphasis on it at all. Or others emphasize it so much that it sounds like it's a form of wrath. And we have to carefully walk the line here to teach this accurately to God's people. You know, when I went through high school, my major was basketball. I really didn't apply myself very much academically. God had given me a decent mind. I probably could have done better if I tried. And I remember graduating, and I was so happy to get out of that place. But at the same time, I saw all my friends go forward and get rewards for math or excellence in scholarship, and I didn't. And so I went through that graduation sort of mixed in my emotions. I was happy to be leaving, but at the same time, I was sort of looking back, and there was a moment of regret. What if? And I think that's what the judgment seat of Christ is like. Yes, you're in heaven and you're with Jesus and it's great, but you kind of look back and you just say, wow, I wish I had allowed the Lord to use me or work in my life a little bit more. This takes us to our sixth and final question. Exactly how are we going to be judged? And I have four fast things to talk you through here. Number one, we're going to be judged individually. If you're in the worship team, you're not going to be there with all your worship team leaders. I'm not going to be there with all my fellow preachers. It's an appointment between God and myself. You say, well, how do you know that? 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 5 says, each man's praise will come from God. Romans 14 verse 12 says basically the same thing. It uses the word each. In other words, we are judged as individuals. Number two, how are we judged exactly? Number two, we are judged as stewards. We're not judged for success, we're judged for faithfulness with what we have, related to the three T's, time, talent, and treasure, post-conversion. I mean, what exactly do we do with those things to advance God's purposes on the earth? I don't think the issue so much is ability, but it's availability. And I think it's going to be shocking to see who's rewarded and who's not. There's an awful lot of big-name people out there that probably will receive a minimal reward, if any. And some anonymous person that's just faithful with what God has given them to do suddenly is given this massive reward from God. And it's going to be a very interesting thing to stand and watch how all of this ferrets itself out in the providence of God. Number three, and to be completely honest with you, this one scares the absolute daylights out of me, is we're judged for our motives. God doesn't just see to us, He sees through us. You say, where are you getting this from? It's in 1 Corinthians 4. And verse 5, where He will bring to light the things hidden in darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts. Isn't it an amazing thing that you can do the right thing with the wrong motive? There was a man named Judas that was like that, wasn't there? He got mad at Mary when she was pouring that expensive ointment on Christ. In fact, he said in John 12, verse 5, this ought to be sold and given to the poor. I mean, how altruistic can you get? But then you read verse 6 of John 12, and it says he said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, and as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was in it. That's the judgment seat of Christ right there. All these altruistic things that people do, God gets right to the motive, and He tries to figure out why they did it, not what they did. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7 says, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Wow. That's a problem for me because I know my heart is wicked. Jeremiah 17 verse 9 says, the heart is deceitful more than above all else. Who can comprehend it? That's why Proverbs 4 verse 23 says, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life. Why am I up here talking to you today? Is it because I like the sound of my own voice? Is it because I want you to think I'm smart? My heart is wicked like that. I can have these ill-fated motives, and all of that comes out at the judgment seat of Christ. And then this one is also very convicting. I think we're going to be evaluated based upon whether we relied upon divine grace to serve or whether we tried to gin it up in the flesh. John 15, verses 1 through 8, Jesus in the upper room talked about a branch and a vine. He said, if the branch is in the vine, it bears fruit. If the branch is separated from the vine, it's good for nothing except to be thrown into the fire.